Under our general subject this evening, we must pause for a moment and consider a few phases of social anthropology. We are thinking in terms of the adjustment of the individual to the society of his time and his integration on a social level. Perhaps we should try to investigate a little more closely the basic relationship between a person and his society. By society today, we mean essentially a culture level or a culture pattern, a situation which constitutes an immediate environment to the person throughout the years of his life, and which certainly does bear an important part in the formation of his character. Social anthropologists have approached this problem in several ways. First, to determine the duty of the person to his culture, and to answer the pressing problem, what do we gain by adjustment? What are we integrating the individual into? What is the essential value of his being adjusted to a situation or a condition which in many ways he basically resents, and into a social structure which in many respects does not satisfy his cultural instincts? Our anthropologists point out that there are at least three major ways of looking at the relationship of society to the individual. The first concept is that society, or the social growth of mankind, is a gradual evolutionary development taking place in various areas and developing independently. In other words, we can now speak of Chinese culture, or Greek or Latin culture, or Egyptian culture, or Hindu culture. These various streams to one school represent the moral experience and experiment of peoples growing up in areas for the most part comparatively isolated in the earlier periods of formative areas of their growth. To this kind of thinking, we can liken the life of the small child that, brought up within a certain kind of parental environment, may later have to go out to experience a general world situation. But its character and its nature are largely influenced by its early environmental pressures. Cultures as we know them today are mostly at an advanced state, but in their developments and in their origins, they arose in isolated regions and were comparatively distinct before they began to merge or mingle with each other. On this assumption, some groups feel that there is no essential need to assume that there is a basic or inevitable culture, that there is no reason to assume that culture is one process unfolding through countless races and almost unimaginable eras of time. The second group follows what has been termed the diffusion theory. This is substantially the belief that culture is one essential growth, that by diffusion it means simply that culture in various periods, perhaps prehistoric, was distributed from some hypothetical center, and that this cultural development is therefore the development or unfoldment of one theory, one concept, one essential program, modified by the areas in which it is at various times separated or even isolated. But actually, that culture is a term for the essential process of social growth, and that this process is essentially the same everywhere, that there is only one culture, but that this culture manifests in varying degrees according to the platforms of social achievement attained by different peoples. There is now a third point of view, which is largely psychological, but which is also shared among several groups of scientists in different areas, and this is that culture is essentially a production of man's own personal consciousness, that culture is merely a moving into manifestation of the person himself. The culture is therefore mysteriously and continuously contemporary, and the apparent descent of it by an evolutionary formula is merely due to that peculiar relationship which causes human beings to proceed from one area or level of thinking or feeling to another. Therefore, culture or society is actually the immediate complex of peoples at various stages in their own development, and that therefore there is very little difference between culture and fashion. That fashions are tremendous forces moving through human consciousness of short duration and not essentially to be regarded as reasonable, other than perhaps as some form of psychic symbolism. This group will go so far as to assume that the society we live in, create, or form is a psychic symbol of our own pressures, our own neurotic trends and tendencies, and the peculiar restrictions or limitations of our own understanding. I think we should consider all three of these because the modern thinker, confronted with several evils, always chooses all of them in order that he may perhaps confound his own mind, but also lest he leave out something which he may later need. These processes, like so many other basic issues of human life, still defy a clear and certain analysis. They are still largely in a theoretical state or condition, because until we do solve man, we will never probably be able to find the ultimate answer to any question bearing upon man's life. But we do have certain relative information. On the theory that we first stated of the independent rise of cultures, we do understand how cultures in actual racial or religious groups may remain comparatively separate, and that as long as the people do not mingle with their neighbors or the stranger beyond their gates, that they have a comparatively homogeneous culture. Therefore, that their culture patterns are simpler, their cultural directives are more clear, their cultural purposes are more immediately understood by each member of the group. If, however, a number of different cultures meet within an area or a location and produce what we might term a heterogeneous culture, then we have conflict between the essential patterns by which individuals attempt to create a social life. The heterogeneous culture is perhaps as well illustrated in our own country as anywhere else in the world. We have very few roots in the ancient traditional forms. Yet we have gathered here peoples from many different cultural patterns. These peoples have, to a measure, perpetuated their own cultures among strangers as well as their own. And today we have what someone has tried to distinguish as an American culture. Just exactly what this is, we are not sure. But it seems to mean the American way of life, the American way of doing things. It is a way which seemingly is quite different from that of other peoples. But the question arises as to whether or not it is a chemical compound formed from other cultures which have contributed their various degrees of influence to our way of life. There seems to be some evidence for this in our attitudes toward cultural artifacts or to the things which cultures produce. Our home furnishings, our architecture, even the clothing that we wear, all these show distinct influences of compound cultures. We are still tremendously influenced by French clothing designers. We have derived our architecture from nearly everywhere, and the various borrowings become strata, resulting in almost constant architectural change and the outmoding of things which not long ago were considered stylish, and the reverse process, the coming back into mode of things regarded as decadent but a short time ago. As we look about us, we see the tremendous amount of cultural borrowing. We find it also in language, where we discover the many different lingual groups that have contributed to the wealth of our vocabulary. We see it in a measure in our educational systems, which blend the findings of many different schools and periods of educational concept. Thus, there seems to be some ground for assuming that we have a polyglot culture, a culture that has arisen from the heterogeneity of our way of life, its comparative youthfulness, and yet at the same time the extraordinary development and precocity which it exhibits. As to the second theory, considering culture to be merely a diffusion from some X point no longer obvious, it seems that there are some defenses for this point of view also, but they are not as strong as those which we have mentioned for the first point of view. On the basis of the diffusion concept, we do recognize that many of our ways of life do represent a moving in of other cultures, as we have previously noted, but that also this diffusion concept should assume that somewhere there is a root of our own peculiar kind of culture, that we are moving according to a definite pattern and plan. The evolution of culture, for example, might support the idea of cultural diffusion. If culture is an inevitable pattern unfolding through time, moving from within itself rather than from external factors, then the evolution or diffusion of cultural process may be accepted. This is still, however, more theoretical than the evidences of borrowing which we have previously mentioned. The third position also comes into our daily life. To what degree is the individual himself immediately causing his own culture here and now? I think we may say there are considerable instances which would support such an idea. The invention of the automobile, for example, certainly produced a major cultural change that could not be explained by the polyglot theory nor by the mere diffusion theory. Here the individual suddenly imposes a major variation upon his way of life. This variation, having certain causation within it, immediately begins to modify the basic elements which hold culture together and force these elements into new patterns. Motion picture, television, radio, all these have done the same thing. And now the development of nuclear physics forces an entirely new attitude upon the world. Therefore, there is something definite to be said in favor of the idea that culture is a continuous manifestation of the emergencies of human nature. On these different patterns, then, we must come to some basic idea as to our own relationship with this complicated situation. When we think psychologically of adjusting a person to the society to which he belongs, what are we actually saying? We are actually saying that we wish him to adjust to the prevailing attitudes in religion, politics, law, art, science, education, and all of the different modifying or contributing elements which have created his contemporary way of life. Now, adjustment in this sense does not investigate or even explore the problem of the integrity of that to which he adjusts. We are to adjust, for instance, to a political concept. We believe in this concept. In many instances, however, we doubt it. In many conditions and situations that arise, we regard it as inadequate. Many individuals resent it. Yet it constitutes a prevailing mode of things. The same is true of the world of arts. We are not in common agreement as to whether modern music is adequate. Yet we are assumed to adjust, or if we cannot adjust by an enthusiastic acceptance, at least by a grudging acquiescence to whatever the prevailing pattern may be. We are not sure that we approve entirely of the way that medicine is practiced, but this is the way it is practiced. Should we adjust to it? We are not at all convinced that our educational system is what it should be. Yet we are in it and part of it. And the average individual finds no way of personally resisting the pressures of the conditions around him. That which he cannot successfully resist, he must therefore contemplate as something perhaps to which he should adjust. So man adjusts to culture mostly today by a negative attitude, one in which he is not satisfied but finds no adequate solution to his own dissatisfaction. In recent years, however, the cultural pattern of our way of life has broken down dramatically and tragically. As we watch from day to day, this cultural pattern loses more and more of its basic integrities. We were once told that this was not true, that the reason why we thought this way is because we were habit-ridden and therefore were unable to adjust to progress. That what we called change was really progress in disguise, and that we could not penetrate the disguise because of inadequate attitudes or facilities, or because we were crystallized into some previous concept. Today, we no longer believe this. We do not believe that all change is progress. We do not believe that it is inevitable that change must be for the better. Nor are we certain that adjustment to change is the solution to problems. The negative attitude that man must adjust to progress has also had some rather unfortunate byproducts. One of these byproducts has been the rapid loss of human creativity. The acceptance of something which is not satisfactory does not strengthen the individual's resources. It weakens him more and more and forces him to become ever increasingly dependent upon that which he does not approve. Thus, We have observed, in recent years especially, a continual loss of individual creativity. We are not able to produce solutions. In other words, we are not able to rescue society from its own dilemma. We are merely able to share in the dilemma, and this is not progress. Psychologists take the attitude, and many of them, rather practically minded persons, probably have a certain immediate fact to support their opinion, namely that what cannot be cured must be endured, and that therefore adjustment to the situation enables one to endure that situation with less strain, wear, and tear upon his own psychic integration. To a measure, this is certainly true. Most of the history of progress, real progress, has shown that the leaders of progress were persons of exceptional courage and exceptional individual insight, and that only by means of these powerful factors in their own temperaments were they able to endure the perils of leadership. This is not the type of thinking for the average person. He does not wish to be a martyr. He does not wish to be penalized for individuality. Therefore, he finds the simpler way to follow paths of conformity. So what we may term adjustment or integration today is in many instances only conformity. It is the individual accepting what he regards as the lesser of two evils and assuming that it is better to drift with the majority and enjoy the certainties and uncertainties of the majority than to strike out desperately into an individual course for which he is not even prepared. That this situation should develop is a reflection upon our educational theory, which is leading us in the general direction of conformity. As it is a conformist function in our society, it does not inspire us to produce individuals capable of standing against trends, motions, and prevailing attitudes. This then brings us to the very heart of our little problem tonight. We're going to integrate. Now, how are we going to do this in a manner that accomplishes something of permanent good for ourselves and perhaps a little good for other people? On the ground that most disturbed persons are certainly unadjusted, and that in many cases this type of unadjusted state is really a rather private thing, that it does not touch all aspects of our social existence, then perhaps we have to approach integration on two levels. One is the immediate problem of our personal environment, and the other is the larger problem of our relationship to the total program of human growth. Now, it is quite probable that in the solution to many of his problems, man does not require a vast insight into large sociological motions in space. He is more concerned with the immediate adjustment of his own life to the problems which surround him so that he can live in a comparatively relaxed manner. Now, relaxation can arise from several different approaches to a problem. One way to become almost completely relaxed is to become intoxicated. This means that you gradually lose the capacity to worry about anything, and you are in the relaxed, happy, jovial state of a pleasantly minded imbecile. This situation simply means that you are happy because you do not think. One individual who was noted in the community in a small southern town for his comparatively perfect adjustment said that the reason why he had this was because he had certain deficiencies in temperament. He was rather ashamed of these deficiencies, but he couldn't help them. He said, for example, I know that there are many times when I should worry, but I just can't keep my mind on it. Now, this delightful state is the primordial infantile state of man. It goes back to his own immediate infancy, in which he had no responsibility and depended utterly upon the wisdom of those around him for survival. If he survived, and he probably did, to a measure at least, he was not the product of his own ingenuity, but simply depended upon the currents of life which drifted him gradually toward maturity. The second attitude on this problem of how we can differentiate the happy person is to take the individual who has developed within himself an attitude. This attitude may be wrong or right. It may be solutional or non-solutional. It may be significant or insignificant. But it is an attitude. And this attitude becomes a strong, leading, guiding factor. The individual is adjusted because he is moving in a manner which conforms with his attitude. He has decided how he was going to live. Happiness is his ability to live that way. Unhappiness, interference in this program or project. Thus, we do have a considerable number of persons who seemingly are able to go through life with a minimum of psychic stress or tension simply because they have an attitude. This attitude is so dominant that it blots out all evidence contrary to itself. Or it is so completely absorbing that it does not permit the mind to wander into any area of uncertainty. One way, of course, to keep an attitude of this kind in a state of constant efficiency, so that it's really present at all times to support us, is to remain ignorant. By so doing, we never learn anything contrary to the attitude. We do not know how other people think, therefore we do not care. Further than this, what they think does not mean enough to us to cause us to question our own conduct in any particular. This person is nicely adjusted. He is adjusted in the sense that psychic stress will not be his outdoing in any immediate problem. Now, the third attitude which can result in adjustment is a more or less strong devotional life. The devotional life is a life clinging to certain invisible truths, principles or realities affirmed to be more important than society. This individual finds the fullest expression of his life in the continuing service of these principles. Now, he does not exactly parallel the person who simply limits himself by his ignorance. This person may be a comparatively advanced scholar. He may be thoroughly acquainted with the great principles of religion and philosophy. He may have devoted his life to the search for values which are real and enduring. And as he has accumulated this mass of related data, he has gradually elevated his spiritual convictions to a condition or level in which they are beyond all social significance. Society becomes comparatively unimportant. He lives in a world in which he believes that the principles that he holds sacred are universal principles, and that if society conforms or does not conform, this is not a primary concern of his. He is not seeking status. He is not seeking to be recognized as a conformist. Rather, he finds his security, his strength, and his integration in the fact that he believes that the code which he follows is superior to any social code that can be set up by man. This may lead him to a series of decisions, some of which may be actually antisocial. But he does not care, because he does not regard society as in any way exercising a dominant influence over his life. There are many instances of persons of this kind who have departed from life as we know it, in the daily way of things, have retired as hermits into the wilderness, have joined monastic orders, have renounced possession, and having given up most of the ties which bind the individual to society as we recognize it, no longer regards society as a dominant. He no longer feels that he has to bow to it, adjust to it, accept it, or compromise for it. He has substituted for social adjustment his distinct and determined effort to adjust himself to the will of God or the mysteries of universal and natural law. He has chosen between the laws of man and the laws of God, and has chosen the laws of God. Such a person, however, is seldom a lawbreaker on the level of human laws, because nearly all codes of man-made laws are based upon a concept of divine right and justice. Consequently, he is not, as a person, likely to be an illegal member of society. He is simply, as he feels it, superior to and apart from the social integration surrounding him. Now, another person who has his part to play in this situation also is the person who believes very sincerely and definitely that the social pattern represents a standard or a challenge to which he must adjust. He regards, for example, the social pattern in this sense, and we have a number of persons of this type. Suppose we have a person who says to himself, the social pattern is a discipline. The social pattern is a way of life which can only be endured by a person who conquers many other elements and pressures in his own personality. Society hands many individuals heavy personal responsibilities. Therefore, to some, the acceptance of these responsibilities becomes the basis of ethics. The individual feels that his acceptance is the measure of his own maturity. That regardless of the weight of the problem, regardless of the personal sacrifice he must make, it is his duty to fulfill certain obligations and responsibilities rising either from his own decisions or from the decisions of his contemporaries. He believes that society depends upon teamwork, and that therefore he must play with his team, and that this constitutes the only acceptable way of life for him. Remember that this adjustment, like all the others, is due to his own acceptance of what constitutes essential value. If he is accepting value, and accepts it with a full heart and a full consciousness, he is not very likely to become neurotic. It is where the acceptance of value becomes not a fulfillment, but a burden. Not a symbol of personal achievement, but as a frustration of personal life. It is then that we have trouble. Now we have other levels and other people attempting to adjust with society. We have the person who, by being essentially negative in terms of will — this does not necessarily mean that he is unintelligent. It does not mean that he is uneducated. It simply means that in this person's nature, there is no instinct to rebel. And there are people of this kind. There is no willfulness or determination to resent situations that occur. The person simply is a creature of more or less total acceptances. Whatever comes, that's it. That's what must be done now. The life, therefore, lived in a state of almost complete relaxation to the fact of things, escapes a good many of the tensions and pressures of the rebellious type of mind. This person who does not resent or resist frequently has a comparatively long and often useful life, because he wastes no energy either misunderstanding or attempting to understand. Problems are not problems to be analyzed. They are situations to be immediately met. Consequently, this type of person doesn't even ask why the problem comes. He simply sees it and knows that he has it. And from that point on, the only answer seems to be to solve it. This type of person has a good many advantages and also represents a rather interesting psychological type. The main trouble with him is that in his acceptances there is frequently very little censorship. He does not differentiate between his real responsibilities and false responsibilities. He does not differentiate in his own action between that which is helpful to others and that which in one way or another is not helpful. This kind of person takes on someone else's work and does it, never realizing that he is weakening the other person by doing their work. This has led to a concept which has arisen which questions the virtue of patience as to whether it is wise or good in long-range terms of adjustment for the individual to accept without discrimination, without the willingness to try to determine that which is his job and that which is not his job. This, of course, fringes into a number of minor divisions, which in one way or another are assuming jobs that are not theirs, sometimes in a simple effort to help, sometimes merely to exercise the pressure for leadership and domination, which often comes when we over-influence the lives of other people. Now, this list of possible relationships to society can be considerably extended, but it probably will not be useful to go very much further in this direction, other than to point out that there are many ways in which the individual can react and does react to things happening around him in terms of social integration or adjustment. Psychologically, the question then seems to clarify itself that we have a person under tension. Now, tension represents in some way an inharmonious adjustment with something. Our first thought is that it is an inharmonious adjustment with someone else. We now begin to realize that it can also be an inharmonious adjustment with ourselves. An individual can be tense all by himself on a desert island. He can be tense trying to live with himself. But this type of symbolism does not particularly intrigue us, and we immediately turn to try to place our tensions on someone else's doorstep. We want someone else to be responsible. But if we have tension, there is something obviously wrong. Now, we can take a person who, we will say, becomes almost adequately adjusted to the society of his time. Let us say that we resolve to play the game just as everyone else does, that we're going to be a shining example of sheer normalcy. Normalcy being nothing more or less than a series of compromises of some kind. As has been pointed out before, normal, the normal person, really means the average person. Normalcy is average. To be like everyone else is to be average, or to be like a majority is to be average. But this does not mean that the majority is normal. But assuming that we are going to be like other people, is this going to end our tension? Are we going to then be a shining example of perfect adjustment? Well, let's take a case point. Our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, everybody we know, everyone we admire, has moved out to the north end of the valley and has bought themselves a miniature rancho, about 150 feet square, which was sold to them as an estate. They are now 25 or 30 miles from their job, but they are just adjusted. They are like everybody else. So now they fight twice a day on the freeway and become nervous wrecks. Now they are like average. They are average. They're doing what 700,000 or 800,000 other people have done in Los Angeles area. Some have been so ambitious that they commute from San Diego. And I suppose in time they will be commuting from Denver in Canada. If this becomes the way that most people do it, and you do it, you're average. But what else are you? Exactly. Furthermore, you will be going back to the psychologist almost immediately because you cannot live with yourself or anyone else. After you reach the point where you begin to talk to yourself in the car, addressing your remarks, of course, to the driver in front who can't hear you, there may be some doubt as to your integration. But this is average. There are many other equally peculiar things that average people do. And if we do them, we shall be average and equally peculiar. Now, some of these things do not mean much. We can be a little foolish and probably survive. But if we simply conform, does this mean that we are going to be healthy? I've been reading some statistics lately that look a little bit astonishing. We've been talking so much about various degrees of tension and so forth among the American people, and I've often reported what I had heard, namely that nearly 50% of our people are known to be, to some degree, neurotic. The latest figure is that there are only 15% of our people who are not. We're climbing rapidly. Now, if the 85% of our people are now neurotic, to what is the individual going to adjust in order to be normal? Is he going to adjust to the average, which will mean that he must be neurotic? Or is he going to stand with that 15% that may fade away while he stands with them? What is the answer as to how he shall estimate his own, we'll say, adequate adjustment? It becomes more and more evident that he cannot adjust with prevailing policy and survive. He cannot adjust with the trends that are now dominating public thinking, because these trends are not essentially sound. The persons who are now thinking that way are miserable and are rapidly passing from a misery to a malady. And those who attempt to follow in their footsteps will do the same. We are fad-ridden. We are loaded with false values and false valuations. We have completely lost the sense of value and are really competing ourselves into an early grave. Can we adjust with this? I doubt very much if we can. It's in the same problem as with a family. How is a person going to adjust his own life to an impossible relative? The relative has no intentions of adjusting to anything. The relative will not go and seek help or be willing to admit they need counseling The relative is going to continue to do exactly as they please. So we go to counsel. We try everything we can do to figure some way to adjust ourselves to this mysterious malady in our family. How long and how much adjustment is necessary to enable an average person to live with an impossible one? That is the question. Now, how are we going to work out this adjustment, assuming that we will not get a 50-50 situation? Well, we have several ways of looking at it. Some say we should live with it. Some say we should live above it. Some say we should live around it. And others say we should walk out. Now, all of these have their advantages and their disadvantages. But in the ordinary sense of the word, the person who must accommodate his own way of life to a situation that is itself basically unfair, this person must suffer in some way, regardless of the nobility of his mind or his generosity or his patience or his effort at understanding. Nobody can enjoy and relax in the continual presence of injustice. This is a social situation. It doesn't make any difference whether this injustice is a member of our own family or an unjust law among nations. To adjust to injustice can only be accomplished by some form of tremendous personal sacrifice. It may mean that the person has recourse to practically every resource that he possesses. He may take refuge in his religion, as one said not long ago, quietly winning the martyr's crown. You're going to have some jewels in it when they get somewhere else. But polishing a future crown does not necessarily make the present life endurable, nor reasonable. The individual who is moved by a certain faith to accept the injustices of others without complaint will also become neurotic whether they admit it or not. And in this situation, there will be more trouble. Also, the situation never being really cured because one person gives and the other person takes will perhaps result in serious trouble for children, will destroy many of the values of life, and interfere with the individual growth of everyone concerned. Something's wrong. How do we adjust to it? What are the standards by which we are going to try to make ourselves an acceptable member of our society? Certain common, ordinary adjustments we can all make without too much trouble. But as these adjustments become more complicated and deeper and more meaningful, we have to pause and consider, because we cannot live with a situation that insults our intelligence or, in one way or another, offends our integrity. These things we just can't do satisfactorily over a long period of time. So the next question arises, how is the person going to meet what might well be termed some form of integration, or achieve it, which does not insult his intelligence or offend his conscience or demand some unreasonable compromise of his principles? The answer seems to be to all of this that psychology of integration has mostly to do with the relation of the person to himself. Psychology isn't willing to admit this entirely, but is beginning to move pretty definitely in the direction of recognizing that there has to be some way, some universal ethics, by means of which an individual is not required by circumstances to offend his own conscience. Because this offense against conscience is a certain cause of mental emotional sickness. If we are then to adjust to something, to what must we adjust? And the answer in this situation seems inevitable, namely that we have to adjust to the core of our own internal conviction, that the normal person is actually the individual who is leading an enlightened life from within himself. That this is normal, as by way of almost a facetious remark, we must say the individual must be normal if he is the only one left. That in this case, normalcy is a relationship with himself and not a relationship with society. Normalcy and integration are therefore the individual moving as a coordinated unit in which all the parts of himself are working together. In order, therefore, to be normal, by this meaning, able to be moved from within self adequately, the answer must be that the self must become an adequate leader. And here's where our big problem is today. We are trying to adjust people to themselves and each other without taking into consideration the fact that somewhere inside of these adjusting beings, there has to be an adequate personal integrity. And this integrity has to arise from an inward comprehension of values. If we are going to depend upon ourselves for our directives, then these directives must come. And a person who is profoundly ignorant of every essential value has not these directives. His dependence upon social adjustment is therefore in a measure related to his lack of individual power or ability to make decision and to sustain his own code according to his own conscience. Therefore, we must admit that the ignorant man, or the man lacking internal directive, must continue to be unadjusted. The only hope he can have is to be average, and to suffer from the more common and familiar ailments, rather than unique ones of his own devisement. If he is average, he will live as average people live, die from the problems that kill average people, weep when average people weep, and laugh when average people do so at the broad suggestions of their favorite comedians. This problem of averageness is the refuge of the person who does not have very much internal directive. Now, you can't have this internal directive unless you develop it. And the only forms of internal directive that we know at the present time that are adequate are the creative powers of religion, philosophy, and art. These are the most direct dynamics of value. These directives work upon the person from within himself, giving him career, giving him purpose for his own existence, giving him incentive, and at the same time providing him with the skills necessary to do the things that he believes to be most worth doing. Also, as his concepts of what are worthwhile things develop, he becomes more and more willing to voluntarily sacrifice the unimportant to the important, the insignificant to the significant. He therefore determines for himself what he will give up in order to attain something else. And because he arrives at the decision of adjustment in this way himself, he is without conflict. Thus, the answer to integration means that there is only one level upon which people can actually constructively unite, and that is on the level of their own fullest experience of maturity. We may say that the bodies of creatures may come into proximity, but that only unities of consciousness can result in a powerful identity, or we might say an integration. The only thing that can integrate us are the noblest sentiments and thoughts of our lives, for in these we do come nearer and nearer together. And when we talk to two persons, both of whom have led devoted and dedicated lives seeking to advance the public good, when we talk to two such persons, we find that they have much in common, that they understand each other because they have experienced the same incentives and the same psychic directives. But when we talk to very selfish people, or persons without these creative pressures within themselves, there is very little understanding, because those who are without internal light are entirely intolerant of each other. Consequently, if we want to integrate, we must unite upon the highest patterns which we are capable of devising. We must unite in creativity and in construction, not in the indifferent policies of compromise, which can never lead to any strong bond of enduring sympathy or understanding. Then let us summarize this phase of our problem something in this way, that for the individual who wishes to survive the pressures of his times, integration is the union within himself of the various elements of his own life and purpose, and the dedication of this unity of achievement to the fulfillment of some reasonable and proper end. This person, then, does not have to be adjusted, because he is an individual. On the other hand, he is not antisocial. And the antisocial person is simply one who is uncomfortable in society. The person whose directives are clear is comfortable in society, regardless of where he is, because he is a self-directing being. Let's try to clarify that point a little more. Integration is, to a measure, a matter of insight. Insight is the ability of people to understand not only themselves, but each other. Understanding, or true insight, is one of the most powerful instruments to relax tension. Insight is our ability to estimate the facts of things, and not to become over-opinionated or the victims of opinions.